From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the discovery of three ancient skulls in Ethiopia that are over 150,000 years old, and what they tell us about human evolution. We talk with paleontologist Tim White. He led the team that uncovered the fossils. Also, we remember stage and screen star Hume Cronyn. He and his wife, the late Jessica Tandy, were one of America's most famous acting couples. He died last weekend at the age of 91. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush says the international community must make it clear to Iran that it is not allowed to develop nuclear weapons. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
White House officials have said they believe Iran is working to build a nuclear weapon. Iran says that's not true, that its nuclear program is for electricity only. But the president, speaking to reporters before a meeting with congressional leaders at the White House, said that the U.S. will not tolerate an Iran with nuclear weapons. He also praised those Iranian citizens involved in massive pro-democracy protests over the past week.
I appreciate those courageous souls who speak out for freedom in Iran. They need to know America stands squarely by their side. And I would urge the Iranian administration to treat them with the utmost of respect.
The Iranian government has arrested many of the protesters and says such statements of encouragement amount to interference in the country's internal affairs. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
A U.S. Army general in Iraq says his troops found cash and weapons during a raid near the city of Tikrit. Major General Ray Odierno said the raid was prompted by tips from ordinary Iraqis.
Soldiers from 122 Infantry conducted two raids on separate farmhouses outside of Tikrit, seizing $8.5 million U.S. dollars, 300 to 400 million Iraqi dinar, and English pounds and euros yet to be counted.
Odierno said the money may have been set aside by Saddam Hussein loyalists to pay paramilitaries and offer bounties for the killing of American troops. A report by Amnesty International has found that many children who are illegal migrants face harsh treatment in immigration detention. Advocates are hopeful for change now that care for such children has been moved to the Department of Health and Human Services. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Some 5,000 illegal child aliens are detained every year. Some have fled war or persecution. Others may have been smuggled in. But the Amnesty report found that many face difficult conditions well after arriving. In a survey of 33 detention facilities, Amnesty found that many use strict punishment, including solitary confinement, often for the smallest of offenses. The use of shackles and frequent strip searches is also widespread. About half have no lawyer. Officials at Health and Human Services say they plan to expand the list of pro bono lawyers available for child aliens and to move more into foster care settings. Human rights groups are lobbying for more money toward that effort. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 29 points to close at 9,293 in active trading. Declining shares led advances by 5-3. The Nasdaq gained 8 points today. It closed at 1,677. This is NPR News. The Texas legislature will hold a special session to decide congressional redistricting. The issue was one of the most controversial in the regular session that ended 2 weeks ago. Janet Heimlich reports from Austin.
Texas Governor Rick Perry has announced the special session will begin June 30th. Special sessions are reserved for issues that are considered a high priority and are not dealt with during the regular session. The issue of redistricting drove a wedge between Democrats and Republicans in the Texas House a few months ago when more than 50 Democrats left the state. Without a quorum, a bill addressing the issue and backed by U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay went nowhere. In a letter sent to legislative leaders, Governor Perry said the legislature, not the federal courts, should be responsible for drawing voting districts. The current congressional district map was drawn by the courts after state lawmakers failed to approve a plan in 2001. The legislature has 30 days to come to an agreement. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
The House voted today to permanently repeal the estate tax. The measure passed on a mostly party-line vote with the support of Republicans, who say that the tax puts a burden on families that inherit small businesses and farms. House Speaker Dennis Hastert said the measure is about protecting families. Democrats say the tax would give more than $160 billion in tax relief over 10 years to the wealthiest 2% of Americans without any effect on the remaining taxpayers. They said it will only contribute to the federal deficit. Under the tax cut passed 2 years ago, the estate tax would be dropped for 1 year in 2010, but be reinstated the following year. The measure faces strong opposition in the Senate. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy. On the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may have read the news about the three ancient skulls, over 150,000 years old, that were discovered in Ethiopia and gave us new clues about the early origins of human beings. My guest, Tim White, is the paleontologist that led the team which made the discovery. White is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. He has co-directed research projects in Ethiopia since 1981. He works in a rift valley that was formed 30 million years ago when the Earth's crust there cracked. It's known as the Ofir Triangle or Ofir Depression. White has made several discoveries in Ethiopia of hominid fossils that advanced our knowledge of evolution. Hominids are the beings that evolved after the split with the last common ancestor that we share with chimpanzees. Let's start with White's latest discovery, the skulls. What do they tell us about the evolution of our form of hominid, the Homo sapien?
Well, for a long, long time, people have been wondering, where did anatomically modern people come from? That's sort of the last step in our evolutionary journey. There were forms found in Europe known as the Neanderthals, and these have centered in a debate on human evolution for about a century and a half. It turns out that the Neanderthals are a specialized European side branch, and it turns out that our own ancestors, Homo sapiens, the earliest Homo sapiens, are African. And we've known this for about the last 20 years as the genetic data have come in. They've pointed to Africa, but the genes can't tell you about the anatomies or the behaviors, the lifestyles of these ancient people. You need evidence for that from the fossil record. And the Ofir Triangle in Ethiopia is a place that has now yielded that evidence at a really key time period that was previously sort of a blank. It's 160,000 years ago, or roughly 10,000 human generations, and we've now recovered the remains of these people, not only the adult, but also a child's cranium, that tell us a great deal about the anatomy of these earliest Homo sapiens.
I think a lot of us grew up thinking or learning in school that our descendants were the Neanderthals. So that's not true?
Well, the Neanderthals were found first in Europe, but it turns out that they go extinct about 30,000 years ago. And the genetic data for the last 20 years have been accumulating and pointing to Africa as the source of our own species. The problem is we haven't had a fossil record. Now we have found people who look very much like you and I, who are much older than Neanderthals, and show that our roots lie outside Europe and that Neanderthals evolved in Europe as a special cold-adapted form, a very, very close relative of ours, but not a direct ancestor. Most of my colleagues see the strange body forms and strange cranial form of the Neanderthals as something related to a cold adaptation. I think the thing that's important to remember here is that Europe was periodically refrigerated during the last million years. Large portions of Europe were buried deep in an ice sheet at the same time that our ancestors were living in Africa on the shore of this tropical lake butchering hippopotamus.
So when you're talking about cold-adapted species, you're not talking about a foggy day in London town. You're talking about the Ice Age.
That's right. The southern edge of that continental ice sheet was a very tough place to live, and the Neanderthals did so successfully for a very long time, but eventually seemed to have been replaced in Western Europe. And for this, we have to think of Western Europe as a peninsula. And the tip of the peninsula is Portugal and Spain, and indeed, that's the very last place you find Neanderthals at about 30,000 years ago. After that, there are no more.
No, you not only got evolutionary news from your digs about the anatomy of man, but you learned about the behavior of our ancestors, our prehistoric ancestors. And the information you've gotten from this isn't just from this latest dig. It's from a whole series of digs that you've done in Ethiopia over about the past 20 years. What are some of the behavioral things that you've learned about ancient man?
Well, we've been able to look at behavior not only from the anatomy, but also from the stone tools, the implements that people have left behind on these ancient landscapes that have been buried and are now being eroded and coming available to us to investigate. The very oldest technologies that we find are, in fact, in this area and a study area just to the north of us, where we find basically broken rocks with sharp edges at around 2.5 million years ago. The hominids employing those technologies had much smaller brains than ours, much more primitive faces. They're placed in the genus called Australopithecus, very unusual forms, bipedal, but with brain sizes that are only slightly larger than modern chimpanzees. And yet they were on very open landscapes using these broken rocks to cut meat from carcasses and to break into the animal bones to retrieve marrow. This starts at around 2.5 million years ago, and we have a succession of technologies that become more and more sophisticated all the way up through time in this one region in the Middle Awash of Ethiopia, where we can calibrate that evolution of technology. And by the time you get to the uppermost layers, up at around 160,000 years ago, the people are making far more than broken rocks. They're making very sophisticated stone tools known as hand axes. They're making flakes in a very specialized preparation known as a Levallois technique, where a core of stone is formed and a single flake is driven off with a very, very sharp edge. Often these are made on volcanic glass. So we can, in a sense, we can recapture the evolution of technology by studying these sediments and their contexts.
Now, one theory that I've read is when our ancestors start using tools that allow them to eat animals, to butcher animals, that helps increase the size of their brains because the food is so rich in protein. And therefore, when these primitive tools are developed, more tools start being developed by our ancestors more quickly because their brains are developing because of the ability to eat meat. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. And the reason for that is that a large lion with a very large brain would be a very scary thing. And lions eat lots and lots
Good
of meat.
Point.
And they don't have big brains like we do. I think it's important to look at the context that these developments occur in. And that's one of the things we do on this project. It involves a very large team of people. We have geochemists, geologists, archaeologists, all working together to understand these ancient landscapes, not just the hominids that occupied them, but the entire ecological setting. And I think that we have to think carefully about what a bipedal primate with small canine teeth and still a rather small brain at 2.5 million years ago was doing in an open habitat messing around with large animal carcasses. This is a very, very dangerous place to be in Africa because there are lots of large carnivores out there. And so as this primate moved into that niche, lots of different new selective pressures came to bear on the primate. And I think that those pressures are responsible over the succeeding 2 million years of evolutionary time for producing a lot of the anatomical and behavioral changes that we see in reading this geological record for human evolution.
Do these anatomical changes include being able to run away quickly from the beasts?
In fact, we're not very good at running away from anything compared to all of the other quadrupeds. And that's why, in fact, when you look at mammals, most of them are quadrupeds. So we tend to think of our bipedality as something very special, allowing us to have freed hands to do lots of things with. But in fact, it's not very beneficial in terms of locomotion.
But it's helpful in creatively coming up with tools to kill the animals that are about to attack you.
Once you adopt handheld weapons and things like that, that's certainly true. But this bipedality we've been able to trace now back in the African record, back beyond 4 million years ago. And at that stage in human evolution, there were no stone tools. There were no implements whatsoever that we have been able to recover from the record. So the origins of bipedality is a major research question that we're still investigating. In fact, we're working on a partial skeleton of a creature that lived 4.4 million years ago, also from the Middle Awash. So we have, in one region of Ethiopia, the ability to examine human evolution from its very beginnings, the earliest bipeds, all the way up to the earliest Homo sapiens, which are these recent fossils from Ethiopia.
Now, you examined, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you examined the skeleton of a Neanderthal that showed that there might have been cannibalism.
Well, that's some work that I have done with a French colleague at a cave site in southern France. And indeed, in the archaeological record, not only of Neanderthals, but also of humans, there's a cave site in South Africa that shows this. There are many occurrences in the American Southwest among a people known as the Anasazi that show this. We have evidence that human bodies were processed, butchered, and broken, the bones broken to extract the marrow, the cranial vault broken to extract the brains, and the discard of all of these broken pieces of bone matching animal bones. And in those instances, we have inferred that cannibalism occurred. Cannibalism, of course, being the consumption of hominid tissue. And for these Neanderthals in southern France, it's pretty clear that what was going on here was a form of cannibalism. In the more recent discoveries, the ones that we've just announced from Ethiopia, we can't make a statement as strongly about cannibalism because the hominid remains themselves were found as isolated skulls on a landscape. They were within about 200 meters of one another, and they show clearly that some form of mortuary ritual was going on. Sometimes cannibalism is a part of these rituals. We know that from looking at ethnographic reports in modern people from places like Papua New Guinea. But with the ones in Ethiopia, we don't find that pattern of breakage and discard with animal bone that characterizes other cannibalized assemblages. Rather, we find some sort of a removal of the cranium from the body. We know this because we found no other body parts with these ancient Ethiopians. And some sort of a processing which involved the removal of tissues. And subsequent to the removal of the tissue, the cranium, the cranial base of the child, was expanded to the point where bone was broken away to open up the bottom of the vault. And then the cranium of this child was repeatedly handled for some period of months or years before it came to be fossilized in this sand unit. And so we're looking at some kind of a mortuary ritual that we don't understand the full dimensions of yet. We don't have the rest of the body, which would be critical in understanding what's going on with the whole sequence of sort of ritual that's happening after the death of the individual.
When you say mortuary ritual, do you mean something like ancestor worship?
Yeah, the place that we see this in the ethnographic record is particularly in Papua New Guinea, where a lot of people have heard about the cannibalism there. These people did involve cannibalism in their mortuary practice, and of course the Kuru disease is one result of that. But the bones themselves, after those rituals were completed, were kept around, and they were sometimes placed on poles outside the men's houses. I've seen photographs of individuals who are actually using the skull of an ancestor as a pillow to sleep on. And that sort of handling of the cranium involves sometimes decoration, sometimes they paint them, sometimes they acquire a polish. And we see those traces on these very early fossils from Ethiopia at 160,000 years ago. And what that suggests to us is that there was some sense of a mortuary practice, whether you call it a religion, a ritual. Something was going on after the individual was dead. And we really don't understand. It's a sort of an ancient mystery without very many clues, and we've just gotten the first ones. And we may be able to figure out more about it.
So cannibalism might not be a question of eating other similar homonyms to stay alive, but rather it might be a kind of almost spiritual way of imbibing the remains of the dead to keep them around after they have departed.
Exactly. That's the kind of ritual cannibalism that we see most often in the ethnographic record. And if indeed cannibalism were practiced in the Ethiopian past at 160,000 years ago, that's probably what's involved. We do know that these crania were removed from the bodies, manipulated, the flesh removed from them, and then handled quite a bit before they were buried in this sand unit. And so that shows the earliest evidence of this concern with the body after the death of the individual.
My guest is paleontologist Tim White. He led the team of researchers that discovered three ancient skulls in Ethiopia, which reveal new clues about human evolution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is paleontologist Tim White, and he led the team that recently found three skulls in Ethiopia dating back to about 160,000 years ago. Do any of the findings you have been responsible for contradict the way Darwinian evolution was taught to you?
Well, the way that Darwinian evolution was taught to me was in the somewhat gradualistic mode, the idea that there was a gradual acquisition of the various parts of our anatomy through time, and it all pretty much came together. And my late colleague Steve Gould was perhaps the best spokesman for a somewhat different point of view, that the evolution of a species can take place not just gradually, but many times it can take place where we have a stasis through time and then a rapid evolution into a different form. And for the hominid fossil record, unfortunately, the record is not yet intact enough to test between those two models. We no longer, because of the work of Steve and his colleague Niles Eldridge, we no longer assume gradualism. But we're trying to understand exactly what the rate of acquisition at various characters were. For example, we know now that this peculiar locomotor mode that all humans employ today, walking on 2 feet, very strange for a mammal to do, that this mode of locomotion has been with us for the last 4 million years. And yet the other structure that sets us apart as very unique among mammals is this very enlarged brain, which actually didn't happen until the last 1 million years. So we have a mosaic happening. We have parts of the body evolving early and parts evolving later. And in order to track this evolution through time, to understand what actually happened in human evolution, we just need more and more evidence from the fossil record. And that's, in fact, what this research in Ethiopia is all about. It's designed to go out and acquire new evidence from previously unknown time periods. It's sort of like an exploration of the past without time machines. We use the fossils, we use the contexts that those fossils are found in, and we're trying to bring back lost worlds and to place our ancestors into those worlds.
Is creationism having an effect on your work?
No, it's not. Creationism is the notion that human beings were created a long, long time ago, and there hasn't been any evolutionary change. In our work, we have a very interesting laboratory situation. We have the ability to go back in time and actually test this model of creationism. And what we have found is that it fails entirely. We should find, according to the creationist model, human beings, modern people, all the way back to 6 million years ago. And yet when we go to the deserts of Ethiopia and recover these fossils, let me tell you what we find. We find at 160,000 years ago some skulls that are human beings. They're a little bit different from ourselves, a little more primitive. We go back to 500,000 years ago and we have a form that has very large brow ridges, a very projecting face, and a smaller brain case. Not a modern human by any stretch of the imagination. Now, let's go back to a million years ago, and a graduate student here at Berkeley, Henry Gilbert, found a Homo erectus cranium right in the same study area in a different set of rocks. This thing has a cranial capacity of only 1,000 cubic centimeters. It's about two-thirds as large. We go back to 2.5 million years in this study area. Do we find any modern humans? None at all. We find Australopithecus. We go back to 4.4 million years ago, and we find the most primitive hominid ancestors ever found. And we don't find any modern humans at all. And so what we're finding, the facts that are coming out of the sediments, are completely at odds with the creationist model and completely concordant with the Darwinian evolutionary model for human origins and evolution.
So are you ever invited to debate a creationist, and do you participate in those debates, or do you think it's not worth debating?
Well, what we find is that the creationists have reached conclusions. They're not interested in getting answers, as we scientists are. They already have the answers, and that's fine because they're operating really in the religious realm. Whereas in science, we have lots and lots of questions, and we seek to get evidence to answer those questions. There are many scientists who are religious. There are many religious people who understand the contributions of science. And it is only the religious fundamentalists that refuse to accept the results that science brings us, at least about our evolutionary history.
Paleontologist Tim White led the team of researchers that discovered three ancient skulls in Ethiopia, which reveal new clues about human evolution. He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. White will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with paleontologist Tim White about his fossil discoveries in Ethiopia and what they tell us about the evolution of human beings. And we remember the actor Hume Cronyn. He died last weekend of prostate cancer. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with paleontologist Tim White. He led the team of researchers that discovered three ancient skulls over 150,000 years old in Ethiopia. These skulls give us new clues about human evolution. White has been leading research projects in Ethiopia since 1981. He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Now, the fossils that you found that led you to be able to put together these skulls, would those of us who are not trained in paleontology recognize them as fossils, recognize them as bones, if we had come across them?
If you had come across them whole, sitting on the surface, pristine and shiny, you'd have had no problem in recognizing them. The problem is when these fossils erode onto the surface, they break. They're very, very fragile. They shatter into many pieces. Many of them are still partially buried. And so it requires some special anatomical skills to find a little piece and say, yeah, this one looks like a hominid cranial vault rather than the hundreds of turtle shell fragments that you find out on this landscape. And so that's why we have people on the ground in the field who know how to recognize all the different kinds of mammals that we find. Remember, we're finding literally thousands of fossils on any given day. Most of them turn out to be crocodiles and fish and turtles and things like that. But the people who find these bones can recognize even small pieces as belonging to a hominid. In the case of the two fossils that we've just announced in Nature, the child's cranium had eroded out some years ago and was all broken, scattered in many pieces, over 200 pieces on the surface, whereas the adult was still embedded in the sand, but being embedded in the sand, it was pretty much covered and obscured by the sand. And it really wasn't until we got to the laboratory and started to piece this child's cranium together that we saw the human-like conformation of the skull and the face. And as we cleaned the sand away from the adult, slowly a face emerged, and it was a face that was very different from the face of Neanderthals in Europe, who were contemporaries, and very different from the face of earlier forms from even the same study area in Ethiopia that are evolutionarily more primitive. This was the face of a human being.
Can you share one of your favorite discovery moments where you or one of your colleagues discovered a fossil that led you to uncover a very important finding?
Well, I'll just tell you the story of how this one happened. The 97th season was an El Nino year. We were trapped in Addis Ababa because the area we work in is very, very remote. It's in a lowland of Ethiopia. One has to get there by driving a couple days. The first day you can drive on a winding asphalt road. The second day you turn right and you drop into the Great Rift. And it's a very steep, very rocky terrain until you get to the valley floor, and then you hit the mud if it's been raining, and you can't move at all, and you can't cross the rivers. So we had to wait for these El Nino rains to stop. It delayed us in Addis. We finally got to the field site. We were heading out to find a series of bones out in the 2.5 million-year-old deposits, and we came across the Afar village of Herto, which is a nomadic pastoralist village. It was abandoned that year. The people had moved all of their cows and their sheep and their goats somewhere else. And that created a great opportunity for us because all the dust that you usually have in this area around the village had all been washed away by the El Nino rains. And we saw a lot of stone tools and fossils on the surface. And we said, yeah, we better come back to this. But we were really keen to get to the 2.5 million-year-old place. So we drove on out there, did the work there. My colleague, Berhani Asfaw, went back to Addis Ababa to get more food and fuel to run this operation in the field. And it rained again. So he was cut off up in the highlands. We were down in the lowlands. It wasn't raining down there. It wasn't muddy, so we could still move around on the outcrops and do our work. But one of my colleagues, a French archaeologist from Marseille, had to get back and do his job. And so we said, well, you know, it's a long way to walk, Alban. You're going to have to go across the Awash River to reach the asphalt, which is about a five-hour walk away, and hitch a ride on a truck to get back to town to get on your flight to go back to Marseille. And Alban agreed to all of this. So we took him out to the river in the morning. And the local Afar people living there who were working with us on the site bundled some papyrus reeds together with a nylon rope and put Alban on the top of this thing. I was going to accompany him across the river, and the guy said, you better not do that. you stay here. And I said, no, no, let me go with him across there. He hasn't been to the other side yet. And they said, no, if you go out across the river and the Crocs get you, who's going to pay us? Because they were my workmen. So I said, all right, all right. See you later, Alban. And he left, and he never got to see the skulls that we found about an hour later, because we drove up to the Herto abandoned village where we'd seen this hippopotamus, started to survey, and a Turkish colleague and one of the graduate students here at Berkeley, David DeGusta, found a little piece of cranial vault that he recognized as hominid. And as we went back to that site and started to put yellow pin flags in the ground, we saw the outline of the rest of the cranium there in the sand. And so we knew, based on the archaeology there, that we were in this critical time period in Africa between 100 and 200,000 years ago. We didn't know exactly where we were in that period, and we didn't know exactly what that face looked like. And to make a very long story short, the fossils were then cleaned up, the sediments were dated, the archaeologists did their work, the paleontologists did their identifications. We published the paper last week in Nature.
So it's really a mix of, like, hard work, scouting, and serendipity.
That's right. The last little tiny bit is luck. Everything before
right.
that is not luck.
Right. Once you realize you've made a really important discovery of a fossil-rich site, what do you do to secure that site?
The Afar people are nomadic pastoralists who live in this region, and we work there. With their permission, they allow us to camp near the sites, and we work together with them on the sites in the excavations and in the surveys on the surface. This research is all done under the permit from the Ethiopian government, and that government is responsible for all of the things that we find. So not only do they protect the sites, both the Afar people and the government, but also the antiquities that we find are worked on and kept in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, in the National Museum, where they are, in fact, antiquities, they're national treasures.
Is it ever difficult for you to connect at the same time with the suffering during droughts or famines of the people of Ethiopia and the need to kind of plunge into the distant past and excavate these ancient fossils?
Well, the fossil record takes us back into the past, but it never gives us a very complete documentation of what happened. It's sort of like studying snapshots in time. And the snapshots that come out of Ethiopia during times of drought involve people who are threatened. Their very existence is threatened by a lack of rain, a lack of crops, a lack of food. I think that the record thereby gets skewed even in the modern sense, because Ethiopia is this amazing, diverse, fascinating country, and with a deep cultural history and with amazing resources in terms of the natural resources and the human resources in the country. And so the picture that we have when the world turns its attention to Ethiopia is not an accurate representation of what this country has to offer. And much of what's there in Ethiopia is conditioned by the very forces that we study. These geological forces are the things that led to the emplacement of this unique fossil record that allows us to trace the roots of the modern African landscape down into time, including the roots of our own ancestors.
My guest is paleontologist Tim White. He led the team of researchers that discovered three ancient skulls in Ethiopia, which reveal new clues about human evolution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tim White is my guest. He's a paleontologist who led the team that made the very recent discovery of skulls in Ethiopia that were about 160,000 years old that tell us a lot about the evolution of mankind. How do you find a specific site? When does something become a site where you start digging?
We actually don't dig until we find something exposed on the surface. So in a sense, we let the natural erosion of these sediments do the digging for us. So the key thing is finding the sedimentary packages, and we have a couple of ways of doing that. The most effective is to look at the imagery from aerial photographs and satellites to identify these rocks of a certain reflectance. Of course, you don't know if there's anything in them by way of fossils until you're actually out on the ground walking around with a trained crew to see what's eroding out. And most of what erodes out is crocodile and hippopotamus and fish, because those live in environments that lend themselves to fossilizing things very well. Occasionally, very occasionally, one finds the remains of these hominids themselves.
How do you look for those fossils that have kind of risen to the surface or that are on the surface?
Well, some of them aren't very hard to find. The way that we found this site is I was actually driving the car. I don't find many of the fossils myself, but I work with a great team. And I was driving this vehicle, looked out the window, and saw a hippopotamus cranium eroding out. And this thing is about 2.5 feet long, so it's hard to miss. And we got out of the car and looked around. There were a lot of stone tools around it. So that was not hard to find. The hominid vaults that had broken and scattered on the surface were much harder to find. Dr. Asfaw, my Ethiopian colleague, found one that's about a square inch of the side of the cranium of the child. And then we had to do a very large operation to collect all of these broken pieces. We run them through a 2-millimeter sieve and recover all of them. And, of course, you get the odd tortoise, scute, and so forth that you take out, and then you put the rest of this back together to make up the fossil that ultimately gets published.
Is your work very seasonal? Are there periods when there's too much rain or it's too hot and you just can't do your work?
Well, it's always too hot, and that's because we're so low in elevation. We're down there in the deep in the rift, one of the hottest places in the world, in fact. But our biggest problem is rain, because we're way off-road. We use SUVs, and we need the SUVs. And they're always in four-wheel drive, unlike most of them on the roads in the United States. We reach the edge of the asphalt and drive for about 8 hours to get to the field site, across rock and through mud and across rivers. The problem is, when it rains in the highlands of Ethiopia, these rivers fill with water and we can't get the vehicles across them. When we tend to go is November, December, and January of each year, when it is the driest in the Afar. This particular year in 97, where we found all these hominids, it was raining a little more than we had hoped, and that's why we couldn't get to the field for such a long time that season. But when we finally did, we saw that there'd been a lot of erosion due to the rains out there, and that was, in fact, a sort of bumper crop of new fossils on the surface.
Once you find a site, do you put something over it to protect it from future rains?
Well, only if we've excavated it and disturbed it. Then we'll cover it with rocks and inform the local people so that they can watch it and protect it. Since most of our work is just walking across the ground and finding these fossils as they erode out, we don't alter things very, very much.
Do you think you see yourself any differently than you used to because of everything that you're learning about our hominid ancestors?
I think that what this study does more than anything else is to really inform you about the extreme brevity of our lifetimes when compared with the enormity of the geological record. And we speak of these hominids at 160,000 years ago as if they're recent. And geologically, they are recent. But if we think of this in terms of generations, these Ethiopians lived 10,000 human generations in the past. And what that would mean, if I were to sort of describe that to you, I'd have to say, great, 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 great. And I have to say it for 40 minutes to get through all of the generations to get back to these, our most recent of the common, of these hominid ancestors.
So it makes you feel like your life is about the length of a finger snap.
It puts it all in perspective, yes, indeed.
So what's next for you? What's the next work that you're doing?
Well, we have a study area that is so incredible because of the great time depth that it offers us. We're always busy on one aspect or another of this study area. So we're going to target two things for next season. One is a new lava flow that we've found with animal bones underneath it. And we've just gotten the dates from this lava flow from the Geochron Center here in Berkeley. It comes in at 6 million years ago. So this affords us a chance to go back beyond the 6 million year mark. Very, very interesting time period. Very close to the time that we split from the chimpanzees. And the other time period that we're interested in is around 250,000 years ago. We've located a body of sediments up in the north of the study area. We have a lot more dating, a lot more field work to do, and we're hoping to find the ancestors of these Herto people in those beds. We're very interested to see what happens if we can fill that gap in the fossil record.
One last question. When you're working in Africa and you see a rhinoceros or a hippopotamus, do you feel like you are seeing an ancient animal?
No, not really. When you work in sites that have a lot of wildlife, for instance, down on the Serengeti, you realize the power of the fossil record in connecting these animals with their ancestors. We found footprints of giraffe at this site of Laetoli in Tanzania, and we would look up from that excavation and see modern giraffes crossing just in front of us. And then as we were excavating the hominid footprints, we realized we were looking at the footprints of ancestors who, if they had walked by today, well, actually they do walk by today. That's us. That's all about us. And so that's the power of this fossil record, is not only does it inform you about hominid evolution, but it informs you about the evolution of the entire African fauna.
And so rhinoceroses don't seem any older than, say, giraffes or any other animal, including
hominids.
Well,
the interesting thing about us and these hominid ancestors is they are really, really different from you or I. You would not invite the 4.5 million-year-old Ardipithecus to dinner. and yet, when you look around at the hippos, they're fully recognizable at 4.4 million years ago as hippos. And you would probably not look twice. And so what that is telling us, of course, is that the hippopotamus hasn't changed all that much, but human beings have changed a great deal over the last 4 million years. We have turned from a creature that is effectively an ape on two legs to what we are and who we are today. And the process of that change, that evolution, is what we're really interested in studying. And the past doesn't yield very many clues. You have to go to special places to find leftovers of that past. And it just turns out that this part of Ethiopia is a very, very special place in a very special country that allows us to get that knowledge to learn about these ancestors who were so different in our case from ourselves.
Thank you so much for sharing some of your findings with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Paleontologist Tim White led the team of researchers that discovered three ancient skulls in Ethiopia that reveal new clues about human evolution. He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with actor Hume Cronin. He died Sunday at the age of 91. This is Fresh Air. The actor Hume Cronin died Sunday at the age of 91 of prostate cancer. His long stage and screen career began with his Broadway debut in 1934. He made his screen debut in the Alfred Hitchcock film Shadow of a Doubt. After completing work on the film, he married actress Jessica Tandy. In their 52 years of marriage, they became one of America's most famous acting couples. They performed together in The Gin Game and other plays, as well as several movies, including Cocoon and Batteries Not Included. They were both elected to the Theater Hall of Fame and received the Kennedy Center Lifetime Achievement Award in 1986. Cronin won a 1964 Tony Award for his performance as Polonius in Richard Burton's Hamlet. Cronin was born in London, Ontario. His mother was from the Labatt Brewery family. His father was a financier and a member of Canada's House of Commons. We're going to listen back to the interview Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscoane recorded with Hume Cronin in 1991.
Coming from this well-known and wealthy Canadian family, what was their reaction when you told them that you wanted to be an actor? I think they wanted you to be an attorney.
When I actually said, this is what I want to do, and I was already at university, and I wanted to leave after my freshman year, my father was ill and really couldn't join in the conversations about what I was going to do with my life. My two older brothers, much older, 17 and 18 years older than I am, they had the responsibility with my mother of deciding just which direction I was going to take. And one of my brothers, to whom I was absolutely devoted, we were a very close family, turned to me during this conversation in which I talked about going into the theater, and he said to me, Hume, how many years do you think you can afford to waste? That was a chiller, and I was furious.
Did that make you want to reconsider your decision?
Oh, no, just had the opposite effect. And I got up and I walked away from the meeting. And we were sitting out in the garden having afternoon tea, which was just one of many rituals in the household. And I just walked out of the garden and away down the street and walked for 2 or 3 hours, had dinner somewhere, came home, and my mother's light was still on. And she called to me when I came in, and she said, you mustn't be angry with them. They're only worrying about your welfare. And then she said, I'll make a bargain with you. If you'll go back to college for one more year, finish your sophomore year, and you still want to do this, she didn't say mad thing, but I'll see to it that you go to either the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, England, or the American Academy of Dramatic Art in New York. I didn't suspect she even knew those two institutions existed, but I think she'd done a lot of thinking about it. I think she'd seen which way I was leaning, and I think she'd made a considerable number of inquiries.
You came to New York City in order to make your mark in the theater, and a casting director said to you, you don't look like anything. Did that give you a kind of freedom then to explore, and others maybe, to give you that kind of freedom to explore a whole range of characters?
At the time, it just shocked me deeply. She was actually, she didn't know that she would scar me when she said it. She was actually trying to be very kind and understanding. She said, Mr. Cronin, I think I should tell you that you may have a difficult time. Yeah. And I said, why? And she said, because you don't look like anything. That's not the kind of comment you forget. And then, feeling that she might have been offensive, she immediately covered her tracks very nicely and said, I mean that your best chances of getting a job with nothing but an amateur's experience would be to walk into an office where they are looking for just your type. And she said, I don't know what your type is. Your accent is not just like ours on this side of the border. And you dress rather differently, very nicely, of course, but differently. I find it hard to know just who's going to say, ah, that's exactly what we're looking for.
What kind of roles did you have then early on in your career?
Name it.
You did it. And that's been
I played all sorts of things.
And that's really continued.
And most of them are a great deal older than I actually was. I mean, I've gone the whole gamut now from when I started. It was, I'm afraid you're too young. I'm afraid you're too young. Oh, but you look so young. But you're very young. Now, of course, it's, but you're a bit old, aren't you?
You have collaborated with your wife, Jessica Tandy, really from just about the beginning of your acting careers.
Well, working with her has been an absolute delight. I mean, speaking generally, it doesn't always go smoothly any more than marriage does. I mean, it's a tough contract to live up to, marriage. And it's a tough contract in the theater to work with somebody over and over and over again. I mean, if you asking these questions, how would you like it if every question you asked, someone else was listening and thinking, she didn't ask that question quite right, or she could have asked it better, or she shouldn't have asked it at all. And you never were free of your job without someone standing over your shoulder and perhaps giving you another opinion, or standing behind you and patting you on the shoulder. I mean, it works both ways. But you work together, share the same bed, the same breakfast table, same rehearsal hall, the same performance, same stage, same supper, week after week, month after month, year after year. If you're lucky enough to be in a hit and it runs that long, it can become trying. And where Jessie is so wonderful is that she understands the need for some degree of separation, some degree of escape, some degree of aloneness. I don't mean loneliness. I mean being left alone.
You've been in, certainly on the stage, television, movies. Do you have a preference for one of those mediums over another?
Yes, the theater.
Why?
The stage. Oh, because I think it's the most difficult, because it's the greatest challenge, because I have a far greater degree of control. Once the curtain goes up in the theater on the stage, it's up to the actor. Nobody can meddle. There's no cutter, no editor, no director who can change anything. The director makes an enormous contribution, if he's any good, when you're rehearsing. But once it's turned over to you, and it's just you and the audience, it is just you and the audience.
Hume Cronin recorded in 1991 in conversation with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscowain. He died Sunday at the age of 91. Jessica Tandy died in 1994. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mary Jane Meeker and Patricia Highsmith had both written lesbian novels under pen names when they met in the 50s. Highsmith was best known for her novels Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Their 1950s romance is the subject of Meeker's new memoir. We'll talk with her on the next Fresh Air. Join us.